month that the aristocratic and celebrated Cuvier was propounding his extinction theories in Paris, on the other side of the English Channel, a rather more obscure Englishman was having an insight into the value of fossils that would also have lasting ramifications. William Smith was a young supervisor of construction on the Somerset Coal Canal. On the evening of January the 5th, 1796, he was sitting in a coaching inn in Somerset when he jotted down the notion that would eventually make his reputation. To interpret rocks, there needs to be some means of correlation, a basis on which you can tell that those Carboniferous rocks from Devon are younger than these Cambrian rocks from Wales. Smith's insight was to realize that the answer lay with fossils. At every change in rock strata, certain species of fossils disappeared, while others carried on into subsequent levels. By noting which species appeared in which strata, you could work out the relative ages of rocks wherever they appeared. Drawing on his knowledge as a surveyor, Smith began at once to make a map of Britain's rock strata, which would be published after many trials in 1815, and would become a cornerstone of modern geology. The story is comprehensively covered in Simon Winchester's popular book, The Map That Changed the World. Unfortunately, having had his insight, Smith was curiously uninterested in understanding why rocks were laid down in the way they were. "I have left off puzzling about the origin of strata and content myself with knowing that it is so," he recorded. "The whys and wherefores cannot come within the province of a mineral surveyor." Smith's revelation regarding strata heightened the moral awkwardness concerning extinctions. To begin with, it confirmed that God had wiped out creatures not occasionally, but repeatedly. This made him seem not so much careless as peculiarly hostile. It also made it inconveniently necessary to explain how some species were wiped out, while others continued unimpeded into succeeding eons. Clearly, there was more to extinctions than could be accounted for by a single Noachian deluge, as the biblical flood was known. Cuvier resolved the matter to his own satisfaction by suggesting that Genesis applied only to the most recent inundation. God, it appeared, hadn't wished to distract or alarm Moses with news of earlier, irrelevant extinctions. So, by the early years of the 19th century, fossils had taken on a certain inescapable importance, which makes Wistar's failure to see the significance of his dinosaur bone all the more unfortunate. Suddenly, in any case, bones were turning up all over. Several other opportunities arose for Americans to claim the discovery of dinosaurs, but all were wasted. In 1806, the Lewis and Clark expedition passed through the Hell Creek formation in Montana, an area where fossil hunters would later literally trip over dinosaur bones, and even examined what was clearly a dinosaur bone embedded in rock, but failed to make anything of it. Other bones and fossilized footprints were found in the Connecticut River Valley of New England, after a farm boy named Plinus Moody spied ancient tracks on a rock ledge at South Hadley, Massachusetts. Some of these at least survive, notably the bones of an Ankylosaurus, which are in the collection of the Peabody Museum at Yale. Found in 1818, they were the first dinosaur bones to be examined and saved, but unfortunately weren't recognized for what they were until 1855. In that same year, 1818, Caspar Wistar died, but he did gain a certain unexpected immortality when a botanist named Thomas Nuttall named a delightful climbing shrub after him. Some botanical purists still insist on spelling it Wistaria. By this time, however, paleontological momentum had moved to England. In 1812, at Lyme Regis, on the Dorset coast, an extraordinary child named Mary Anning, aged 11, 12, or 13, depending on whose account you read, found a strange fossilized sea monster, 17 feet long, and now known as the Ichthyosaurus, embedded in the steep and dangerous cliffs along the English Channel. It was the start of a remarkable career. Anning would spend the next 35 years gathering fossils, which she sold to visitors. She is commonly held to be the source of the famous tongue-twister, "She sells seashells on the seashore." She would also find the first Plesiosaurus, another marine monster, and one of the first and best pterodactyls. Though none of these was technically a dinosaur, that wasn't terribly relevant at the time, since nobody then knew what a dinosaur was. It was enough to realize that the world had once held creatures strikingly unlike anything we might now find. It wasn't simply that Anning was good at spotting fossils, though she was unrivaled at that, but that she could extract them with the greatest delicacy and without damage. If you ever have the chance to visit the Hall of Ancient Marine Reptiles at the Natural History Museum in London, I urge you to take it, for there is no other way to appreciate the scale and beauty of what this young woman achieved, working virtually unaided with the most basic tools in nearly impossible conditions. The plesiosaur alone took her 10 years of patient excavation. Although untrained, Anning was also able to provide competent drawings and descriptions for scholars, but even with the advantage of her skills, significant finds were rare, and she passed most of her life in poverty. It would be hard to think of a more overlooked person in the history of paleontology than Mary Anning, but in fact there was one who came painfully close. His name was Gideon Algernon Mantell, and he was a country doctor in Sussex. Mantell was a lanky assemblage of shortcomings. He was vain, self-absorbed, priggish, neglectful of his family, but never was there a more devoted amateur paleontologist. He was also lucky to have a devoted and observant wife. In 1822, while he was making a house call on a patient in rural Sussex, Mrs. Mantell went for a stroll down a nearby lane, and in a pile of rubble that had been left to fill potholes, she found a curious object, a curved brown stone about the size of a small walnut. Knowing her husband's interest in fossils, and thinking it might be one, she took it to him. Mantell could see at once it was a fossilized tooth, and after a little study became certain that it was from an animal that was herbivorous, reptilian, extremely large, tens of feet long, and from the Cretaceous period. He was right on all counts, but these were bold conclusions, since nothing like it had been seen before or even imagined. Aware that his finding would entirely upend what was understood about the past, and urged by his friend the Reverend William Buckland, he of the gowns and experimental appetite, to proceed with caution, Mantell devoted 3 painstaking years to seeking evidence to support his conclusions. He sent the tooth to Cuvier in Paris for an opinion, but the great Frenchman dismissed it as being from a hippopotamus. Cuvier later apologized handsomely for this uncharacteristic error. One day, while doing research at the Hunterian Museum in London, Mantell fell into conversation with a fellow researcher who told him the tooth looked very like those of animals he had been studying, South American iguanas. A hasty comparison confirmed the resemblance, and so Mantell's creature became Iguanodon, after a basking tropical lizard to which it was not in any manner related. Mantell prepared a paper for delivery to the Royal Society. Unfortunately, it emerged that another dinosaur had been found at a quarry in Oxfordshire and had just been formally described by the Reverend Buckland, the very man who had urged him not to work in haste. It was the Megalosaurus, and the name was actually suggested to Buckland by his friend Dr. James Parkinson, the would-be radical and eponym for Parkinson's disease. Buckland, it may be recalled, was foremost a geologist, and he showed it with his work on Megalosaurus. In his report for the Transactions of the Geological Society of London, he noted that the creature's teeth were not attached directly to the jawbone, as in lizards, but placed in sockets in the manner of crocodiles. But having noticed this much, Buckland failed to realize what it meant. Megalosaurus was an entirely new type of creature. So although his report demonstrated little acuity or insight, it was still the first published description of a dinosaur. And so to him, rather than the far more deserving Mantell, goes the credit for the discovery of this ancient line of beings. Unaware that disappointment was going to be a continuing feature of his life, Mantell continued hunting for fossils. He found another giant, the Hylaeosaurus, in 1833, and purchasing others from quarrymen and farmers until he had probably the largest fossil collection in Britain. Mantell was an excellent doctor and equally gifted bone hunter, but he was unable to support both his talents. As his collecting mania grew, he neglected his medical practice. Soon fossils filled nearly the whole of his house in Brighton and consumed much of his income. Much of the rest went to underwriting the publication of books that few cared to own. Illustrations of the Geology of Sussex, published in 1827, sold only 50 copies and left him £300 out of pocket, an uncomfortably substantial sum for the Times. In some desperation, Mantell hit on the idea of turning his house into a museum and charging admission, then belatedly realized that such a mercenary act would ruin his standing as a gentleman, not to mention as a scientist, and so he allowed people to visit the house for free. They came in their hundreds, week after week, disrupting both his practice and his home life. Eventually, he was forced to sell most of his collection to pay off his debts. Soon after, his wife left him, taking their four children with her. Remarkably, his troubles were only just beginning. In the district of Sydenham, in South London, at a place called Crystal Palace Park, there stands a strange and forgotten sight. The world's first life-sized models of dinosaurs. Not many people travel there these days, but once this was one of the most popular attractions in London. In effect, as Richard Forte has noted, the world's first theme park. Quite a lot about the models is not strictly correct. The iguanodon's thumb has been placed on its nose as a kind of spike, and it stands on four sturdy legs, making it look like a rather stout and awkwardly overgrown dog. In life, the iguanodon did not crouch on all fours, but was bipedal. Looking at them now, you would scarcely guess that these odd and lumbering beasts could cause great rancor and bitterness. But they did. Perhaps nothing in natural history has been at the center of fiercer and more enduring hatreds than the line of ancient beasts known as dinosaurs. At the time of the dinosaurs' construction, Sydenham was on the edge of London, and its spacious park was considered an ideal place to recreate the famous Crystal Palace, the glass and cast-iron structure that had been the centerpiece of the Great Exhibition of 1851, and from which the new park naturally took its name. The dinosaurs, built of concrete, were a kind of bonus attraction. On New Year's Eve, 1853, a famous dinner for 21 prominent scientists was held inside the unfinished iguanodon. Gideon Mantell, the man who had found and identified the iguanodon, was not among them. The person at the head of the table was the greatest star of the young science of paleontology. His name was Richard Owen, and by this time he had already devoted several productive years to making Gideon Mantell's life hell. Owen had grown up in Lancaster, in the north of England, where he had trained as a doctor. He was a born anatomist, and so devoted to his studies that he sometimes illicitly borrowed limbs, organs, and other parts from cadavers, and took them home for leisurely dissection. Once, while carrying a sack containing the head of a black African sailor that he had just removed, Owen slipped on a wet cobble and watched in horror as the head bounced away from him down the lane and through the open doorway of a cottage, where it came to rest in the front parlour. What the occupants had to say upon finding an unattached head rolling to a halt at their feet can only be imagined. One assumes that they had not formed any terribly advanced conclusions when, an instant later, a fraught-looking young man rushed in, wordlessly retrieved the head, and rushed out again. In 1825, aged just 21, Owen moved to London, and soon after was engaged by the Royal College of Surgeons to help organise their extensive, but disordered, collections of medical and anatomical specimens. Most of these had been left to the institution by John Hunter, a distinguished surgeon and tireless collector of medical curiosities, but had never been catalogued or organised, largely because the paperwork explaining the significance of each had gone missing soon after Hunter's death. Owen swiftly distinguished himself with his powers of organisation and deduction. At the same time, he showed himself to be a peerless anatomist, with instincts for reconstruction almost on a par with the great Cuvier in Paris. He became such an expert on the anatomy of animals that he was granted first refusal on any animal that died at the London Zoological Gardens, and these he would invariably have delivered to his house for examination. Once his wife returned home to find a freshly deceased rhinoceros filling the front hallway. He quickly became a leading expert on all kinds of animals living and extinct, from platypuses, echidnas, and other newly discovered marsupials, to the hapless dodo and the extinct giant birds called moas that had roamed New Zealand until eaten out of existence by the Maoris. He was the first to describe the Archaeopteryx after its discovery in Bavaria in 1861, and the first to write a formal epitaph for the dodo. Altogether, he produced some 600 anatomical papers, a prodigious output. But it was for his work with dinosaurs that Owen is remembered. He coined the term Dinosauria in 1841. It means terrible lizard, and was a curiously inapt name. Dinosaurs, as we now know, weren't all terrible. Some were no bigger than rabbits, and probably extremely retiring. And the one thing they most emphatically were not was lizards, which are actually of a much older, by 30 million years, lineage. Owen was well aware that the creatures were reptilian, and had at his disposal a perfectly good Greek word, herpeton, but for some reason chose not to use it. Another more excusable error, given the paucity of specimens at the time, was that dinosaurs constitute not one, but two orders of reptiles. The bird-hipped Ornithischians, and the lizard-hipped Saurischians. Owen was not an attractive person, in appearance or in temperament. A photograph from his late middle years shows him as gaunt and sinister, like the villain in a Victorian melodrama, with long, lank hair and bulging eyes, a face to frighten babies. In manner he was cold and imperious, and he was without scruple in the furtherance of his ambitions. He was the only person Charles Darwin was ever known to hate. Even Owen's son, who soon after killed himself, referred to his father's lamentable coldness of heart. His undoubted gifts as an anatomist allowed him to get away with the most bare-faced dishonesties. In 1857, the naturalist T.H. Huxley was leafing through a new edition of Churchill's Medical Directory when he noticed that Owen was listed as Professor of Comparative Anatomy and Physiology at the Government School of Mines, which rather surprised Huxley, as that was the position he held. Upon inquiring how Churchill's had made such an elemental error, he was told that the information had been provided to them by Dr. Owen himself. A fellow naturalist named Hugh Falconer, meanwhile, caught Owen taking credit for one of his discoveries. Others accused him of borrowing specimens, then denying he had done so. Owen even fell into a bitter dispute with the Queen's dentist over the credit for a theory concerning the physiology of teeth. He did not hesitate to persecute those whom he disliked. Early in his career, Owen used his influence at the Zoological Society to blackball a young man named Robert Grant, whose only crime was to have shown promise as a fellow anatomist. Grant was astonished to discover that he was suddenly denied access to the anatomical specimens he needed to conduct his research. Unable to pursue his work, he sank into an understandably dispirited obscurity. But no one suffered more from Owen's unkindly attentions than the hapless and increasingly tragic Gideon Mantell. After losing his wife, his children, his medical practice, and most of his fossil collection, Mantell moved to London. There, in 1841, the fateful year in which Owen would achieve his greatest glory for naming and identifying the dinosaurs, Mantell was involved in a terrible accident. While crossing Clapham Common in a carriage, he somehow fell from his seat, grew entangled in the reins, and was dragged at a gallop over rough ground by the panicked horses. The accident left him bent, crippled, and in chronic pain, with a spine damaged beyond repair. Capitalizing on Mantell's enfeebled state, Owen set about systematically expunging Mantell's contributions from the record, renaming species that Mantell had named years before, and claiming credit for their discovery for himself. Mantell continued to try to do original research, but Owen used his influence at the Royal Society to ensure that most of his papers were rejected. In 1852, unable to bear any more pain or persecution, Mantell took his own life. His deformed spine was removed and sent to the Royal College of Surgeons, where, and now here's an irony for you, it was placed in the care of Richard Owen, director of the college's Hunterian Museum. But the insults had not quite finished. Soon after Mantell's death, an arrestingly uncharitable obituary appeared in the Literary Gazette. In it, Mantell was characterized as a mediocre anatomist whose modest contributions to paleontology were limited by a want of exact knowledge. The obituary even removed the discovery of the iguanodon from him, and credited it instead to Cuvier and Owen, among others. Though the piece carried no byline, the style was Owen's, and no one in the world of the natural sciences doubted the authorship. By this stage, however, Owen's transgressions were beginning to catch up with him. His undoing began when a committee of the Royal Society, a committee of which he happened to be chairman, decided to award him its highest honour, the Royal Medal, for a paper he had written on an extinct mollusk called the Belemnite. However, as Deborah Cadbury notes in her excellent history of the period Terrible Lizard, this piece of work was not quite as original as it appeared. The Belemnite, it turned out, had been discovered 4 years earlier by an amateur naturalist named Channing Pierce, and the discovery had been fully reported at a meeting of the Geological Society. Owen had been at that meeting, but failed to mention this when he presented a report of his own to the Royal Society, in which, not incidentally, he rechristened the creature Belemnites Owenae in his own honour. Although Owen was allowed to keep the Royal Medal, the episode left a permanent tarnish on his reputation, even among his few remaining supporters. Eventually, Huxley managed to do to Owen what Owen had done to so many others. He had him voted off the councils of the Zoological and Royal Societies. As a final insult, Huxley became the new Hunterian professor at the Royal College of Surgeons. Owen would never again do important research, but the latter half of his career was devoted to one unexceptionable pursuit for which we can all be grateful. In 1856, he became head of the Natural History Section of the British Museum, in which capacity he became the driving force behind the creation of London's Natural History Museum. The grand and beloved Gothic heap in South Kensington, opened in 1880, is almost entirely a testament to his vision. Before Owen, museums were designed primarily for the use and edification of the elite, and even then it was difficult to gain access. In the early days of the British Museum, prospective visitors had to make a written application and undergo a brief interview to determine if they were fit to be admitted at all. They then had to return a second time to pick up a ticket, that is, assuming they had passed the interview, and finally come back a third time to visit the museum's treasures. Even then, they were whisked through in groups and not allowed to linger. Owen's plan was to welcome everyone, even to the point of encouraging working men to visit it in the evening, and to devote most of the museum's space to public displays. He even proposed, very radically, to put informative labels on each display so that people could appreciate what they were viewing. In this, somewhat unexpectedly, he was opposed by T.H. Huxley, who believed that museums should be primarily research institutes. By making the Natural History Museum an institution for everyone, Owen transformed our expectations of what museums are for. Still, his altruism in general toward his fellow man did not deflect him from more personal rivalries. One of his last official acts was to lobby against a proposal to erect a statue in memory of Charles Darwin. In this he failed, though he did achieve a certain belated, inadvertent triumph. Today, his statue commands a masterly view from the staircase of the main hall in the Natural History Museum, while Darwin and T.H. Huxley are consigned somewhat obscurely to the museum coffee shop, where they stare gravely over people snacking on cups of tea and jam doughnuts. It would be reasonable to suppose that Richard Owen's petty rivalries marked the low point of 19th-century paleontology. But in fact, worse was to come, this time from overseas. In America, in the closing decades of the century, there arose a rivalry even more spectacularly venomous, if not quite as destructive. It was between two strange and ruthless men, Edward Drinker Cope and Othniel Charles Marsh. They had much in common. Both were spoiled, driven, self-centred, quarrelsome, jealous, mistrustful, and ever unhappy. Between them, they changed the world of paleontology. They began as mutual friends and admirers, even naming fossil species after each other, and spent a pleasant week together in 1868. However, something then went wrong between them, nobody is quite sure what, and by the following year they had developed an enmity that would grow into consuming hatred over the next 30 years. It is probably safe to say that no two people in the natural sciences have ever despised each other more. Marsh, the elder of the two by 8 years, was a retiring and bookish fellow, with a trim beard and dapper manner, who spent little time in the field and was seldom very good at finding things when he was there. On a visit to the famous dinosaur fields of Como Bluff, Wyoming, he failed to notice the bones that were, in the words of one historian, lying everywhere like logs. But he had the means to buy almost anything he wanted. Although he came from a modest background, his father was a farmer in upstate New York, his uncle was the supremely rich and extraordinarily indulgent financier George Peabody. When Marsh showed an interest in natural history, Peabody had a museum built for him at Yale, and provided funds sufficient for Marsh to fill it with almost whatever took his fancy. Cope was born more directly into privilege. His father was a rich Philadelphia businessman, and was by far the more adventurous of the two. In the summer of 1876, in Montana, while George Armstrong Custer and his troops were being cut down at Little Bighorn, Cope was out hunting for bones nearby. When it was pointed out to him that this was probably not the most prudent time to be taking treasures from Indian lands, Cope thought for a minute and decided to press on anyway. He was having too good a season. At one point he ran into a party of suspicious Crow Indians, but he managed to win them over by repeatedly taking out and replacing his false teeth. For a decade or so, Marsh and Cope's mutual dislike primarily took the form of quiet sniping. But in 1877 it erupted into grandiose dimensions. In that year, a Colorado schoolteacher named Arthur Lakes found bones near Morrison while out hiking with a friend. Recognizing the bones as coming from a gigantic saurian, Lakes thoughtfully dispatched some samples to both Marsh and Cope. A delighted Cope sent Lakes $100 for his trouble and asked him not to tell anyone of his discovery, especially Marsh. Confused, Lakes now asked Marsh to pass the bones on to Cope. Marsh did so, but it was an affront that he would never forget. It also marked the start of a war between the two that became increasingly bitter, underhand, and often ridiculous. They sometimes stooped to one team's diggers throwing rocks at the other team's. Cope was caught at one point jimmying open crates that belonged to Marsh. They insulted each other in print, and each poured scorn on the other's results. Seldom, perhaps never, has science been driven forward more swiftly and successfully by animosity. Over the next several years, the two men between them increased the number of known dinosaur species in America from 9 to almost 150. Nearly every dinosaur that the average person can name, Stegosaurus, Brontosaurus, Diplodocus, Triceratops, was found by one or the other of them. The notable exception being the Tyrannosaurus rex, which was found by Barnum Brown in 1902. Unfortunately, they worked in such reckless haste that they often failed to note that a new discovery was something already known. Between them they managed to discover a species called Uintatheres anceps no fewer than 22 times. It took years to sort out some of the classification messes they made. Some are not sorted out yet. Of the two, Cope's scientific legacy was much the more substantial. In a breathtakingly industrious career, he wrote some 1,400 learned papers and described almost 1,300 new species of fossil, of all types, not just dinosaurs, more than double Marsh's output in both cases. Cope might have done even more, but unfortunately he went into a rather precipitate descent in his later years. Having inherited a fortune in 1875, he invested unwisely in silver and lost everything. He ended up living in a single room in a Philadelphia boarding house, surrounded by books, papers, and bones. Marsh, by contrast, finished his days in a splendid mansion in New Haven. Cope died in 1897, Marsh 2 years later. In his final years, Cope developed one other interesting obsession. It became his earnest wish to be declared the type specimen for Homo sapiens, that is, that his bones would be the official set for the human race. Normally, the type specimen of a species is the first set of bones found, but since no first set of Homo sapiens bones exists, there was a vacancy, which Cope desired to fill. It was an odd and vain wish, but no one could think of any grounds to oppose it. To that end, Cope willed his bones to the Wistar Institute, a learned society in Philadelphia endowed by the descendants of the seemingly inescapable Caspar Wistar. Unfortunately, after his bones were prepared and assembled, it was found that they showed signs of incipient syphilis, hardly a feature one would wish to preserve in the type specimen for one's own race. So Cope's petition and his bones were quietly shelved. There is still no type specimen for modern humans. As for the other players in this drama, Owen died in 1892, a few years before Cope or Marsh. Buckland ended up by losing his mind and finished his days a gibbering wreck in a lunatic asylum in Clapham, not far from where Mantell had suffered his crippling accident. Mantell's twisted spine remained on display at the Hunterian Museum for nearly a century before being mercifully obliterated by a German bomb in the Blitz. What remained of Mantell's collection after his death passed on to his children, and much of it was taken to New Zealand by his son Walter, who emigrated there in 1840. Walter became a distinguished Kiwi, eventually attaining the office of Minister of Native Affairs. In 1865, he donated the prime specimens from his father's collection, including the famous Iguanodon tooth, to the Colonial Museum, now the Museum of New Zealand, in Wellington, where they have remained ever since. The Iguanodon tooth that started it all, arguably the most important tooth in paleontology, is no longer on display. Of course, dinosaur hunting didn't end with the deaths of the great 19th century fossil hunters. Indeed, to a surprising extent, it had only just begun. In 1898, the year that fell between the deaths of Cope and Marsh, a trove greater by far than anything found before was discovered, noticed, really, at a place called Bone Cabin Quarry, only a few miles from Marsh's prime hunting ground at Como Bluff, Wyoming. There, hundreds and hundreds of fossil bones were to be found weathering out of the hills. They were so numerous, in fact, that someone had built a cabin out of them, hence the name. In just the first two seasons, 100,000 pounds of ancient bones were excavated from the site, and tens of thousands of pounds more came in each of the half-dozen years that followed. The upshot is that by the turn of the 20th century, paleontologists had literally tons of old bones to pick over. The problem was that they still didn't have any idea how old any of these bones were. Worse, the agreed ages for the Earth couldn't comfortably support the numbers of eons and ages and epochs that the past obviously contained. If Earth were really only 20 million years old or so, as the great Lord Kelvin insisted, then whole orders of ancient creatures must have come into being and gone out again practically in the same geological instant. It just made no sense. Other scientists besides Kelvin turned their minds to the problem and came up with results that only deepened the uncertainty. Samuel Horton, a respected geologist at Trinity College in Dublin, announced an estimated age for the Earth of 2,300 million years, way beyond anything anybody else was suggesting. When this was drawn to his attention, he recalculated using the same data and put the figure at 153 million years. John Joly, also of Trinity, decided to give Edmund Halley's ocean salts idea a whirl, but his method was based on so many faulty assumptions that he was hopelessly adrift. He calculated that the Earth was 89 million years old, an age that fit neatly enough with Kelvin's assumptions, but unfortunately not with reality. Such was the confusion that by the close of the 19th century, depending on which text you consulted, you could learn that the number of years that stood between us and the dawn of complex life in the Cambrian period was 3 million, 18 million, 600 million, 794 million, or 2.4 billion, or some other number within that range. As late as 1910, one of the most respected estimates by the American George Becker put the Earth's age at perhaps as little as 55 million years. Just when matters seemed most intractably confused, along came another extraordinary figure with a novel approach. He was a bluff and brilliant New Zealand farm boy called Ernest Rutherford, and he produced pretty well irrefutable evidence that the Earth was at least many hundreds of millions of years old, probably rather more. Remarkably, his evidence was based on alchemy. Natural, spontaneous, scientifically credible, and wholly non-occult, but alchemy nonetheless. Newton, it turned out, had not been so wrong after all. And exactly how that came to be is, of course, another story. 7. Elemental Matters. Chemistry, as an earnest and respectable science, is often said to date from 1661, when Robert Boyle of Oxford published The Skeptical Chymist, the first work to distinguish between chemists and alchemists, that it was a slow and often erratic transition. Into the 18th century, scholars could feel oddly comfortable in both camps, like the German Johann Becher, who produced an unexceptionable work on mineralogy called Physica Subterranea, but who also was certain that, given the right materials, he could make himself invisible. Perhaps nothing better typifies the strange and often accidental nature of chemical science in its early days than a discovery made by a German named Hennig Brandt in 1675. Brandt became convinced that gold could somehow be distilled from human urine. The similarity of colour seems to have been a factor in his conclusion. He assembled 50 buckets of human urine, which he kept for months in his cellar. By various recondite processes, he converted the urine first into a noxious paste, and then into a translucent, waxy substance. None of it yielded gold, of course, but a strange and interesting thing did happen. After a time, the substance began to glow. Moreover, when exposed to air, it often spontaneously burst into flame. The commercial potential for the stuff, which soon became known as phosphorus, from Greek and Latin roots meaning light-bearing, was not lost on eager business people, but the difficulties of manufacture made it too costly to exploit. An ounce of phosphorus retailed for 6 guineas, perhaps $500 in today's money, or more than gold. At first, soldiers were called on to provide the raw material, but such an arrangement was hardly conducive to industrial-scale production. In the 1750s, a Swedish chemist named Carl Scheeler devised a way to manufacture phosphorus in bulk without the slop or smell of urine. It was largely because of this mastery of phosphorus that Sweden became, and remains, a leading producer of matches. Scheeler was both an extraordinary and extraordinarily luckless fellow. A poor pharmacist, with little in the way of advanced apparatus, he discovered 8 elements, chlorine, fluorine, manganese, barium, molybdenum, tungsten, nitrogen, and oxygen, and got credit for none of them. In every case, his finds were either overlooked or made it into publication after someone else had made the same discovery independently. He also discovered many useful compounds, among them ammonia, glycerin, and tannic acid, and was the first to see the commercial potential of chlorine as a bleach, all breakthroughs that made other people extremely wealthy. Scheeler's one notable shortcoming was a curious insistence on tasting a little of everything he worked with, including such notoriously disagreeable substances as mercury, prussic acid, another of his discoveries, and hydrocyanic acid, a compound so famously poisonous that 150 years later, Erwin Schrödinger chose it as his toxin of choice in a famous thought experiment. Scheeler's rashness eventually caught up with him. In 1786, aged just 43, he was found dead at his workbench, surrounded by an array of toxic chemicals, any one of which could have accounted for the stunned and terminal look on his face. Were the world just and Swedish-speaking, Scheeler would have enjoyed universal acclaim. Instead, credit has tended to lodge with more celebrated chemists, mostly from the English-speaking world. Scheeler discovered oxygen in 1772, but for various heartbreakingly complicated reasons could not get his paper published in a timely manner. Instead, credit went to Joseph Priestley, who discovered the same element independently, but latterly, in the summer of 1774. Even more remarkable was Scheeler's failure to receive credit for the discovery of chlorine. Nearly all textbooks still attribute chlorine's discovery to Humphrey Davy, who did indeed find it, but 36 years after Scheeler had. Although chemistry had come a long way in the century that separated Newton and Boyle from Scheeler and Priestley and Henry Cavendish, it still had a long way to go. Right up to the closing years of the 18th century, and in Priestley's case a little beyond, scientists everywhere searched for, and sometimes believed, they had actually found things that just weren't there. Vitiated airs, dephlogisticated marine acids, floxes, calxes, terraqueous exhalations, and above all, phlogiston, the substance that was thought to be the active agent in combustion. Somewhere in all this, it was thought, there also resided a mysterious élan vital, the force that brought inanimate objects to life. No one knew where this ethereal essence lay, but two things seemed probable, that you could enliven it with a jolt of electricity, a notion Mary Shelley exploited to full effect in her novel Frankenstein, and that it existed in some substances, but not others, which is why we ended up with two branches of chemistry, organic, for those substances that were thought to have it, and inorganic, for those that did not. Someone of insight was needed to thrust chemistry into the modern age, and it was the French who provided him. His name was Antoine Laurent Lavoisier. Born in 1743, Lavoisier was a member of the minor nobility. His father had purchased a title for the family. In 1768, he bought a practicing share in a deeply despised institution called the Ferme Générale, or General Farm, which collected taxes and fees on behalf of the government. Although Lavoisier himself was by all accounts mild and fair-minded, the company he worked for was neither. For one thing, it did not tax the rich, but only the poor, and then often arbitrarily. For Lavoisier, the appeal of the institution was that it provided him with the wealth to follow his principal devotion, science. At his peak, his personal earnings reached 150,000 livres a year, perhaps $20 million in today's money. 3 years after embarking on this lucrative career, he married the 14-year-old daughter of one of his bosses. The marriage was a meeting of hearts and minds both. Madame Lavoisier had an incisive intellect and soon was working productively alongside her husband. Despite the demands of his job and busy social life, they managed to put in 5 hours of science on most days, 2 in the early morning and 3 in the evening, as well as the whole of Sunday, which they called their jour de bonheur, day of happiness. Somehow Lavoisier also found the time to be commissioner of gunpowder, supervise the building of a wall around Paris to deter smugglers, help found the metric system, and co-author the handbook Méthode de nomenclature chimique, which became the Bible for agreeing on the names of the elements. As a leading member of the Académie Royale des Sciences, he was also required to take an informed and active interest in whatever was topical. Hypnotism, prison reform, the respiration of insects, the water supply of Paris. It was in such a capacity in 1780 that Lavoisier made some dismissive remarks about a new theory of combustion that had been submitted to the Academy by a hopeful young scientist. The theory was indeed wrong, but the scientist never forgave him. His name was Jean-Paul Marat. The one thing Lavoisier never did was discover an element. At a time when it seemed as if almost anybody with a beaker, a flame, and some interesting powders could discover something new, and when, not incidentally, some two-thirds of the elements were yet to be found, Lavoisier failed to uncover a single one. It certainly wasn't for want of beakers. Lavoisier had 13,000 of them in what was, to an almost preposterous degree, the finest private laboratory in existence. Instead, he took the discoveries of others and made sense of them. He threw out phlogiston and mephitic airs. He identified oxygen and hydrogen for what they were, and gave them both their modern names. In short, he helped to bring rigour, clarity, and method to chemistry. And his fancy equipment did in fact come in very handy. For years he and Madame Lavoisier occupied themselves with extremely exacting studies requiring the finest measurements. They determined, for instance, that a rusting object doesn't lose weight, as everyone had long assumed, but gains weight. An extraordinary discovery. Somehow, as it rusted, the object was attracting elemental particles from the air. It was the first realization that matter can be transformed, but not eliminated. If you burned this book now, its matter would be changed to ash and smoke. But the net amount of stuff in the universe would be the same. This became known as the conservation of mass, and it was a revolutionary concept. Unfortunately, it coincided with another type of revolution, the French one. And for this one, Lavoisier was entirely on the wrong side. Not only was he a member of the hated Ferme Générale, but he had enthusiastically built the wall that enclosed Paris, an edifice so loathed that it was the first thing attacked by the rebellious citizens. Capitalizing on this in 1791, Marat, now a leading voice in the National Assembly, denounced Lavoisier and suggested that it was well past time for his hanging. Soon afterward, the Ferme Générale was shut down. Not long after this, Marat was murdered in his bath by an aggrieved young woman named Charlotte Corday. But by this time it was too late for Lavoisier. In 1793, the reign of terror, already intense, ratcheted up to a higher gear. In October, Marie Antoinette was sent to the guillotine. The following month, as Lavoisier and his wife were making tardy plans to slip away to Scotland, Lavoisier was arrested. In May, he and 31 fellow farmers general were brought before the Revolutionary Tribunal, in a courtroom presided over by a bust of Marat. 8 were granted acquittals, but Lavoisier and the others were taken directly to the Place de la Révolution, now the Place de la Concorde, site of the busiest of French guillotines. Lavoisier watched his father-in-law beheaded, then stepped up and accepted his fate. Less than 3 months later, on July the 27th, Robespierre himself was dispatched in the same way and in the same place, and the reign of terror swiftly ended. 100 years after his death, a statue of Lavoisier was erected in Paris and much admired, until someone pointed out that it looked nothing like him. Under questioning, the sculptor admitted that he had used the head of the mathematician and philosopher, the Marquis de Condorcet. Apparently he had a spare, in the hope that no one would notice, or, having noticed, would care. In the second regard, he was correct. The statue of Lavoisier cum Condorcet was allowed to remain in place for another half-century, until the Second World War, when, one morning, it was taken away and melted down for scrap. In the early 1800s, there arose in England a fashion for inhaling nitrous oxide, or laughing gas, after it was discovered that its use was attended by a highly pleasurable thrilling. For the next half-century, it would be the drug of choice for young people. One learned body, the Esquesian Society, was for a time devoted to little else. Theatres put on laughing gas evenings, where volunteers could refresh themselves with a robust inhalation, and then entertain the audience with their comical staggerings. It wasn't until 1846 that anyone got around to finding a practical use for nitrous oxide as an anaesthetic. Goodness knows how many tens of thousands of people suffered unnecessary agonies under the surgeon's knife, because no one thought of the gas's most obvious practical application. I mention this to make the point that chemistry, having come so far in the 18th century, rather lost its bearings in the first decades of the 19th, in much the way that geology would in the early years of the 20th. Partly it was to do with the limitations of equipment. There were, for instance, no centrifuges until the second half of the century, severely restricting many kinds of experiments, and partly it was social. Chemistry was, generally speaking, a science for business people, for those who worked with coal and potash and dyes, and not gentlemen, who tended to be drawn to geology, natural history, and physics. This was slightly less true in continental Europe than in Britain, but only slightly. It is perhaps telling that one of the most important observations of the century, Brownian motion, which established the active nature of molecules, was made not by a chemist, but by a Scottish botanist, Robert Brown. What Brown noticed in 1827 was that tiny grains of pollen suspended in water remained indefinitely in motion, no matter how long he gave them to settle. The cause of this perpetual motion, namely the actions of invisible molecules, was long a mystery. Things might have been worse had it not been for a splendidly improbable character named Count von Rumford, who, despite the grandeur of his title, began life in Woburn, Massachusetts in 1753 as plain Benjamin Thompson. Thompson was dashing and ambitious, handsome in feature and figure, occasionally courageous and exceedingly bright, but untroubled by anything so inconveniencing as a scruple. At 19 he married a rich widow, 14 years his senior, but at the outbreak of revolution in the colonies he unwisely sided with the Loyalists, for a time spying on their behalf. In the fateful year of 1776, facing arrest, for lukewarmness in the cause of liberty, he abandoned his wife and child and fled just ahead of a mob of anti-royalists armed with buckets of hot tar, bags of feathers, and an earnest desire to adorn him with both. He decamped first to England and then to Germany, where he served as a military adviser to the government of Bavaria, so impressing the authorities that in 1791 he was named Count von Rumford of the Holy Roman Empire. While in Munich, he also designed and laid out the famous park known as the English Garden. In between these undertakings, he somehow found time to conduct a good deal of solid science. He became the world's foremost authority on thermodynamics, and the first to elucidate the principles of the convection of fluids and the circulation of ocean currents. He also invented several useful objects, including a drip coffee maker, thermal underwear, and a type of range still known as the Rumford fireplace. In 1805, during a sojourn in France, he wooed and married Madame Lavoisier, widow of Antoine Laurent. The marriage was not a success, and they soon parted. Rumford stayed on in France, where he died, universally esteemed by all but his former wives, in 1814. But our purpose in mentioning him here is that in 1799, during a comparatively brief interlude in London, he founded the Royal Institution, yet another of the many learned societies that popped into being all over Britain in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. For a time it was almost the only institution of standing to actively promote the young science of chemistry, and that was thanks almost entirely to a brilliant young man named Humphrey Davy, who was appointed the institution's Professor of Chemistry shortly after its inception, and rapidly gained fame as an outstanding lecturer and productive experimentalist. Soon after taking up his position, Davy began to bang out new elements one after another, potassium, sodium, magnesium, calcium, strontium, and aluminium, or aluminium, depending on which branch of English you favour. The confusion of the aluminium-aluminium spelling arose because of some uncharacteristic indecisiveness on Davy's part. When he first isolated the element in 1808, he called it alumium. For some reason, he thought better of that and changed it to aluminum 4 years later. Americans dutifully adopted the new term, but many British users disliked aluminum, pointing out that it disrupted the ium pattern established by sodium, calcium, and strontium, so they added a vowel and syllable. He discovered so many elements not so much because he was seriously astute as because he developed an ingenious technique of applying electricity to a molten substance, electrolysis as it is known. Altogether he discovered a dozen elements, a fifth of the known total of his day. Davy might have done far more, but unfortunately as a young man he developed an abiding attachment to the buoyant pleasures of nitrous oxide. He grew so attached to the gas that he drew on it, literally, 3 or 4 times a day. Eventually, in 1829, it is thought to have killed him. Fortunately, more sober types were at work elsewhere. In 1808, a Dour Quaker named John Dalton became the first person to intimate the nature of an atom, progress that will be discussed more completely a little further on. And in 1811, an Italian with a splendidly operatic name of Lorenzo Romano Amadeo Carlo Avogadro, Count of Caracqua and Cerrito, made a discovery that would prove highly significant in the long term, namely, that two equal volumes of gases of any type, if kept at the same pressure and temperature, will contain identical numbers of molecules. Two things were notable about Avogadro's principle, as it became known. First, it provided a basis for more accurately measuring the size and weight of atoms. Using Avogadro's mathematics, chemists were eventually able to work out, for instance, that a typical atom had a diameter of 0.0000008 centimeters, which is very little indeed. And second, almost no one knew about Avogadro's appealingly simple principle for almost 50 years. The principle led to the much later adoption of Avogadro's number, a basic unit of measure in chemistry, which was named for Avogadro long after his death. It is the number of molecules found in 2.016 grams of hydrogen gas, or an equal volume of any other gas. Its value is placed at 6.0221367 times 10 to the power of 23, which is an enormously large number. Chemistry students have long amused themselves by computing just how large a number it is, so I can report that it is equivalent to the number of popcorn kernels needed to cover the United States to a depth of 9 miles, or cupfuls of water in the Pacific Ocean, or soft drink cans that would, evenly stacked, cover the Earth to a depth of 200 miles. An equivalent number of American pennies would be enough to make every person on Earth a dollar trillionaire. It is a big number. No one knew about his principle because Avogadro himself was a retiring fellow. He worked alone, corresponded very little with fellow scientists, published few papers, and attended no meetings. But also it was because there were no meetings to attend, and few chemical journals in which to publish. This is a fairly extraordinary fact. The Industrial Revolution was driven in large part by developments in chemistry, and yet as an organized science, chemistry barely existed for decades. The Chemical Society of London was not founded until 1841, and didn't begin to produce a regular journal until 1848, by which time most learned societies in Britain, geological, geographical, zoological, horticultural, and Linnaean, for naturalists and botanists, were at least 20 years old, and often much more. The rival Institute of Chemistry didn't come into being until 1877, a year after the founding of the American Chemical Society. Because chemistry was so slow to get organized, news of Avogadro's important breakthrough of 1811 didn't begin to become general until the first International Chemistry Congress in Karlsruhe in 1860. Because chemists for so long worked in isolation, conventions were slow to emerge. Until well into the second half of the century, the formula H2O2 might mean water to one chemist, but hydrogen peroxide to another. C2H4 could signify ethylene or marsh gas. There was hardly a molecule that was uniformly represented everywhere. Scientists also used a bewildering variety of symbols and abbreviations, often self-invented. Sweden's J.J. Berzelius brought a much-needed measure of order to matters by decreeing that the elements be abbreviated on the basis of their Greek or Latin names, which is why the abbreviation for iron is Fe, from the Latin ferrum, and that for silver is Ag, from the Latin argentum. That so many of the other abbreviations accord with their English names, N for nitrogen, O for oxygen, H for hydrogen, and so on, reflects English's Latinate nature, not its exalted status. To indicate the number of atoms in a molecule, Berzelius employed a superscript notation, as in H to the power of 2O. Later, for no special reason, the fashion became to render the number as subscript, H2O. Despite the occasional tidyings up, chemistry by the second half of the 19th century was in something of a mess, which is why everybody was so pleased by the rise to prominence in 1869 of an odd and crazed-looking professor at the University of St. Petersburg named Dmitri Ivanovich Mendeleev. Mendeleev, also sometimes spelled Mendeleev or Mendeleev, was born in 1834 at Tobolsk, in the far west of Siberia, into a well-educated, reasonably prosperous, and very large family. So large, in fact, that history has lost track of exactly how many Mendeleevs there were. Some sources say there were 14 children, some say 17. All agree, at any rate, that Dmitri was the youngest. Luck was not always with the Mendeleevs. When Dmitri was small, his father, the headmaster of a local school, went blind, and his mother had to go out to work. Clearly an extraordinary woman, she eventually became the manager of a successful glass factory. All went well until 1848, when the factory burned down and the family was reduced to penury. Determined to get her youngest child an education, the indomitable Mrs. Mendeleev hitchhiked with young Dmitri 4,000 miles to St. Petersburg. That's equivalent to travelling from London to Equatorial Guinea, and deposited him at the Institute of Pedagogy. Worn out by her efforts, she died soon after. Mendeleev dutifully completed his studies and eventually landed a position at the local university. There he was a competent but not terribly outstanding chemist, known more for his wild hair and beard, which he had trimmed just once a year, than for his gifts in the laboratory. However, in 1869, at the age of 35, he began to toy with a way to arrange the elements. At the time, elements were normally grouped in two ways, either by a